Welcome to another episode of the Sunstone Podcast with John Larson. I'm Stephen Carter, host of the Sunstone Magazine Podcast. If you haven't listened to the magazine podcast yet, get a sample by visiting sunstone.org/atom-god-ces to hear an episode about how fragments of the atom-god theory are still taught in the church educational system, and how it's all Charles Darwin's fault. This past weekend, John was at Sunstone Phoenix, where he gave a compelling talk entitled, "You Can Leave the Church, but Can't Leave It Alone," which we are presenting in its entirety here. Enjoy!
I'll warn you that I'm going through menopause right now, so I find myself a lot more weepy lately these days. So if I mean, let's be fair, I grew up in the same tradition you did. That's what men are supposed to do, right? They stand up here and they cry. I figured out that I'm transforming in my menopause to Santa Claus for some reason, which is probably good. You know, I can be a jolly old guy for the rest of my life and eat lots of cookies. Okay. Lindsay has asked me to talk on the subject of leaving the church but not leaving it alone, which is a common insult hurled at ex-Mormons all the time, right? It signifies a significant character flaw somehow, that you were part of this tradition, you were part of this life, you were a part of this congregation, this community, and for whatever reason you decide to change your core belief pattern. And now what you should do is forget about it. Forget about everything you did. And it's a very difficult thing. But I think we should kind of dig in. Where did this come from? You guys know? It was from Glenn L. Pace. Bishop Pace was the bishop in the 80s, and he is best known for the satanic scare that happened during the 80s when the church itself and law enforcement in Utah became convinced that Mormons were doing sacrificial rites of children and other things in temples and in homes, and there was this big satanic scare. That's the legacy of Bishop Pace. So that might give you kind of an idea of where we're coming at in terms of worldview. Here's his quote from the April 1989 LDS conference. "You can leave the church, but you can't leave it alone. The basic reason for this is simple. Once someone has received a witness of the Spirit and accepted it, he leaves neutral ground. One loses his testimony only by listening to the promptings of the evil one. And Satan's goal is not complete when a person leaves the church, but when he comes out in open rebellion against it." What's interesting about that last phrase is he keeps talking about leaving the church. But one can't be in open rebellion if one leaves. The gist of this is you can leave, but you cannot leave. Because the Mormons divide the world, unfortunately, into three categories. There are Mormons and Gentiles, right? And sometimes we can be Gentiles, even when we're Mormons. And sometimes we can be non-Gentiles, even when we're not Jews. But there's Mormons, and there's Gentiles, and there's apostates. And they are three distinct peoples. And that paradigm still is alive and well in the church and outside the church today, that people are treated differently. And Lindsay joked earlier in the session that you know, when she went down to Short Creek, that you know, she thought, well, I'm an apostate. I'm not you know, wearing my garments. But from their perspective, she was no apostate at all. To just like in Mormonism, we honor, you know, if somebody gets up and talks about why they're no longer a Methodist, you know, we honor that story. That's a faith-promoting story to denigrate Catholicism or Protestantism or wherever they came from. And I mean, the golden convert was somebody who was Jewish, right? You would go on the fireside circuit if you converted from Judaism, which is the narrative of destruction of the previous faith, right? But it's a paradigm that we reserve internally. There is an evangelical, I've heard more from evangelicals than I've heard from Mormons. When the question, it's an extension of the theodicy, which is, okay, so you've accepted Jesus Christ into your heart, and now you will be saved. But you know that many people that you love will be relegated to eternal damnation, to suffering for all eternity. How can you possibly enjoy heaven knowing that people that you loved in this life are forever being tortured and in pain and in suffering? How can you possibly have any kind of heaven that way? And the answer typically, if they will give you an answer, is that God will erase from people's minds those relationships. Those people will be forgotten so that the state of happiness can continue. But let's be clear what we're defining here. A state of happiness that can only be achieved by literally denying reality. That by literally, they have a view of the world that they have to not understand it. Their minds have to be cut out in order to live in this paradise. That's pretty heavy stuff, right? There is a believed nirvana state by a lot of ex-Mormons that they're trying to achieve, which is the time that they will no longer remember being a Mormon. They will no longer process the world through Mormon views. They will no longer have that in them. So there's two parts of this that I really want to address in the next few minutes. The Mormon desire to have ex-Mormons go away. And the ex-Mormons desire to forget that they had anything to do with Mormonism at all. Let's talk first about wanting them to go away. Unfortunately, the fragility and insecurity of a movement can be measured by how it treats dissidents and non-believers. It's always true that the more totalitarian a regime is, the more MLM sort of you're selling canned baloney, the more that the people who don't believe, who don't follow along, the people who leave are going to be seen as enemies. When you have things that are well accepted, like let's say you became a dissident of algebra. That you said the laws of algebra are all crazy and you know, like the physics department or the mathematics department would pay you no attention. They wouldn't care because your voice doesn't matter. We can show algebra has value. We can show the necessity. We can say, see, we built this bridge and we launched this missile and all that's due to algebra. But when you have something that's a little bit more tenuous, you really have to patrol the borders, right? Places people don't want to go have fences. Countries where things, funny things are happening, build walls, right? That's a historical truth that we can see. And you know, we can find 300-foot walls, literally, in the deserts of Babylon, sitting there in the sand. Well, they're still there, but whatever it was they were trying to do wasn't accomplished. And the boundary and this wall we're trying to build has the same sort of vacuous results. I have been a longtime student of Mormonism. I was always fascinated by the theology and church is really boring. So you know, you'd sit there and I'd sit and read the Doctrine and Covenants and the Bible sitting there in the pews. I must have read the Book of Revelation 27 times, usually on the first Sunday of every month. And what I will say this, as somebody who studied and criticized and argued, Mormonism as a culture and a philosophical movement is not nearly as fragile as Mormons assume it is. Some of the most interesting and ideas in Mormonism that have legs, that have philosophical teeth, are the ones that they want to run away from. And you know, ideas on eternal families, eternal marriage, the Pearl of Great Price, for how crazy that book is, it's full of all these really interesting theological ideas. And this identity that we have as Mormons is oftentimes based on things that ex-Mormons find very fascinating and outsiders find really intriguing and Mormons just want to hide. And I think it's this quest for identity. Mormonism, I always talk about the golden age of Mormonism that kind of launched in the 50s. It was post-war. And you know, if we go back, Mormon identity was so intertwined with polygamy up until statehood, and then the Smoot hearings, which happened in like 1904, where Senator Reed Smoot was getting grilled, And you can see that's where they questioned the president of the church, and he admitted that he'd never really had a revelation and this stuff. It's all in the congressional record. You can read it. So the church was left reeling. Then World War I came along, and most of the people around in the church got agricultural deferments. We didn't really participate very much in World War I as a people. But World War II, we were more so. And we wanted to cling to an identity. When the post-polygamy period, during those years, we were trying to find something, and we landed on Americanism. We discovered Reader's Digest. And if you read Reader's Digest in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, that's what Mormons wanted to be. They wanted to be quasi-essential Americans. And they were more tolerant and good until a guy named Ernie Wilkinson came along and decided that the counterculture was happening, needed to have a counterculture centered at BYU. And that's when we start getting kind of the Mormon weirdness start sleeping in, the, you know, you can't have beards and that sort of stuff, because the hippies had beards, right? So we weren't going to be hippies. So you have this Mormon identity that's growing and becoming, but then we start getting really nervous about this thing. There's an eye on Mormonism suddenly, and we really want to be like everybody else. The tragic story of the Mormons is following the evangelicals around, which is the wrong crowd to follow around. It's like that weird kid in school who picks the wrong group of kids to hang around, and you're like, no, quit trying to be like the evangelicals. Because we really wanted to be accepted by those guys. So we started hiding the things that made us unique, the things that made us special. There was a conversation a couple nights ago. We were talking about polygamy. And it was brought up that those of us who grew up in Utah or in Arizona or these places in the Mormon corridor back in the day, there was no secret of polygamy. We all knew descendants of polygamists. And I was joking that the stories I heard about polygamy were all cautionary tales. I remember my mom one time talking about, my mother's grandmother, I'm really sounding Mormon now, I'm giving you genealogy. My mother's grandmother was around the polygamists, the Kohabs were still around. So there was an insult my mom told me one time that they would levy, that a woman was so uppity she was acting like a first wife. So this church that has this philosophical movement has been co-opted by a corporation that's modeled itself off of the real religion of America, which is you know, capitalism and mercantilism, right? And it's given us prosperity, but at this age in 2019, we're starting to really count the cost. But Mormonism embraced it full on, and what they did is they took this, what should have been an ecclesiastical center, and turned it into a corporate center. And the reason I bring this up is because we, as ex-Mormons in particular, do not differentiate between the corporate church and Mormon culture, or the corporate church and Mormon people, and that is a mistake on our part, because these things are very different entities. And we can see these crazy decisions coming down from Salt Lake right now, but that is not the Mormon people. And the Mormon people themselves are reeling from some of these choices. And we sometimes act from the ex-Mormon, from the critical perspective, like Mormons are this big unified Borg. They literally say that. It's an insult that ex-Mormons levy at the church all the time. And it's insensitive and it's incorrect. The people, our culture is much more dynamic than all that. It's much bigger. It's much broader. The corporate church is extremely weak and vulnerable. I have to look this up. There is a word called intersubjectivity. You heard of intersubjectivity? It's a fascinating subject. So we all have like imaginary things, like I might go around thinking like there's lizard people in the desert running the government, right? But there's ideas that we all have collectively, and they are just as not real. Like the idea of the Constitution of the United States. If we were to all be wiped out tomorrow, and an alien race came back and did, or we started over again, they would not come back with the Constitution. It's not real. It exists only in our minds. And it's this social contract that we have, right? So the corporate church is very, very weak. But there's this intersubjectivity. There's this thing that exists collectively in our minds that gives them power. That we assume that they're in charge, that they're running things, that they get to decide things like whether or not we call ourselves Mormons. They get to decide if the Springville 14th Ward is going to divide in two. But that is only if we take that on. It's the authority we give them. And so the net outcome for a lot of ex-Mormons is they end up giving a lot of power to the corporate church, in so much that they don't even divide the people, the Mormon people, our heritage and our faith from these guys making corporate decisions down in Salt Lake City. When we take our laser focus off the corporate church, we are able to see a culture and a heritage that is significant and meaningful to the West in particular, and to American history in general. Mormons played a huge role in the expansion of the West. And we're not talking about just, you know, like the desert, the painted desert, the cowboys riding there. Just as we roll forward, this has always been a frontier church. You know, moving from New England to upper state New York to Ohio to Missouri to Salt Lake City, we chased the frontier, right? And we as a people are shaped by that. Mormonism today is as much a result of the desert and what we ran into here and our interaction with the Western people and all that as it is coming from the Book of Mormon. And that's a beautiful and interesting thing. We all have this wild gift. I believe that every religion ultimately starts out as a cult. I mean, a cult is a pejorative we shouldn't even use, but it starts out as a very small group. And they're very cultish in their activity. They're very insular. And some of those occasionally grow into Zoroastrianism, or grow into Islam, or grow into Christianity. What we are seeing right now happening in 2019 is what happens in those early days of a religion. If you study the fragments we can get of early Christianity, you know, in the first and second century after the death of Christ, very different than what came after Constantine and what came after the Council of Nicaea and these sort of things. And we are living in that, and we hate ourselves for it. We don't own what we have because we think it's weird. I have been around this world. Every religion has weird hats. It's universal. Every religion is bizarre to people who don't accept those practices, who see it from the outsider. But it's interesting that if you go all the way to Mongolia, then you'll say, oh, look at this fancy stuff. Look at how they dress. Look how they ride horses. But if you drive to Payson, you're like insulting those people because they remind you too much of yourself. And they remind you too much of the things that you don't like about yourself. And Mormonism has this self-esteem issue. It doesn't help that people like me are criticizing them. But we carry this with us. Corporations, the church, has a relationship to customers. And that's how they look at their revenue streams, and that's how they run it. And we all are buying into the paradigm. We're letting them do it. And because it's this collective idea, we give it power. Weddings, funerals, births, death, transitions should be a time of celebration, a time to bring people together, not a time to secure more funding. And the church has taken the sacraments that are so precious to Mormon people, and they've turned them into a chance to monetize. That is not from Mormon scripture. That is not from Mormon tradition. That is from the corporatization of a movement that you and I own, that's part of our hearts, that's part of our souls, that's part of our genealogy, and we have allowed it to happen. So why, then, does the church not like apostates so much? I joke all the time that there's one thing the church is really good at, it's dealing with apostates, because there's been more apostates made by the church than there's ever been members. They've been leaving from the get-go. We were talking about the Willie Martin handcart company, you know, the ones who kind of froze out on the plains. In 56, what they don't talk about is when the snow first broke in the fall, in the spring, these people were starving, right? Half of them went back home. They turned around and went back home. We don't like to tell the narrative of the people who came out. Will Bagley, the historian, he estimates that as many as half of all people who came to Utah turned around and went back east or went to the West Coast. I don't know if that number is high or low because we didn't record it very well. But you've got this church that is really good at dealing with the naysayers. Excellent. And one of the ways they've dealt with the naysayers is giving them a script of telling us, if you're going to be an apostate, this is how you're going to be an apostate. you're going to do X, Y, and Z. And you know, as ex-Mormons, we follow that narrative. We just do it. I think there's this line that John Hamer was describing it kind of as a centrifugal circle. There's the planet, and you start going out, or you drop a rock in a lake, right? And so you have the core of the church, the true believers, and then you have the fresh ex-Mormons, and they go out on phases and phases and phases. I've been at this for about 15 years of being involved in these communities, and I've seen generation after generation come and go. The people who inspired me, probably half of you in the room haven't heard of. And the people who inspired them, because we keep reinventing the wheel, and we keep reinventing the wheel because we play into the church narrative. We rebel in a certain way, and then we go away, which is exactly what they want, right? They want to box us out of, let's say, a wedding. We get insulted. Who doesn't invite their brother to a wedding? Who doesn't invite their sister to this sort of thing? And then you don't show up to the next activity. And they say, see? You go out and you no longer, you know, you can drink coffee. So you drink coffee and you say, this is pretty damn good. I'm going to drink more coffee, right? But then that's a part of the narrative. You've fallen for their script, right? You're drinking coffee, which is a sign of apostasy. You're not going to church, which is a sign of apostasy. And then we oftentimes amplify those things. You'll see ex-Mormons wearing t-shirts bragging about their coffee, right? There's Jack Mormon Coffee Company. Because the more you jump out of the church, the more ridiculous this stuff seems, which is the more you're playing into their narrative. So they want you to go away. They want you to do exactly what you're doing. And by they, I mean me. We joke that in my heyday, the church never said boo. I never received a letter. I never received anything. They like people like me. What they don't like is people like Denver Snuffer or others who are inside the church trying to agitate for change. They'll go after you. But you leave the church, they know how to handle you because you left the church and you didn't leave it alone, right? And let's address that a little bit more. It's an ex-Mormon desire. What's funny about this particular thing is the ex-Mormons glom onto it as much. I have heard that insult hurled at me more by ex-Mormons than I ever heard by Mormons, right? That why are you still talking about this stuff? Why are you unhealthy? Why do you, and let alone if you identify something good, if you're walking around singing some song your mom sang to you when you were 2 years old, you are a betrayal of the brotherhood, right? Because Mormonism, ex-Mormonism is about deconstruction of some very harmful ideas that caused us pain and continue to cause us pain. But where ex-Mormons fail, and I own this failure as much as anybody, is the failure to rebuild. If you deconstruct a philosophy that people rely on for their moral infrastructure, for their families, for their communities, and you don't provide anything in return, all you're doing is providing a petri dish for the next revolutionary to come along. But let's take this thing. I talked about, I have to look at my word up again, intersubjectivity. Let's talk about intersubjectivity again. What is that sentence? Leaving the church but not leaving it alone. I contend to you that every word in this sentence is false. You cannot leave the church. There is no church. There's only us, right? Church is a building. Church is the fact that we do things the same way. We believe some of the same things. We're neighbors. The church, like I just outlined, is a corporation in Salt Lake City. They make corporate decisions. They print books. They tell people not to call things this. There's things that are routinely ignored. But you can't leave the church because there is no church to leave. But what does leave even mean in this context? You're still living in the same house. You're still with the same neighbors. You're still ostensibly the same person. And I will tell you for sure, the ex-Mormons, especially the fresh ones, they are as Mormon as people come. They leave the church and they invert it. They turn it upside down. But it's still their moral guidepost. But unfortunately, it's their moral guidepost by just reversing everything they did before. Oh, we're not supposed to take heroin? Let's say, no, ex-Mormons don't take heroin. But they do love Fireball whiskey. That is the, if you want to make an ex-Mormon happy, take them a bottle of Fireball. They like that stuff for some reason. No one is leaving. You can't leave. And what does leave it alone mean anyway? What is it? So if I sing primary songs, or I say, you know, I really liked going, you know, being in the Boy Scouts, I really did. I enjoyed being in the Boy Scouts. With all the reform, I do not believe in any gods. I cannot join the Boy Scouts to this day. But for me to suddenly say that the Boy Scouts was not a positive influence on me and part of my life and helped shape who I am today would be a lie. And for me to try to rip Mormonism out of my soul would be a crime, and one in which I have tried to do, and I've tried to help others do, and it's not the right thing. We are who we are, right? I told you I'd kind of blubber a little bit. So we can't leave. We're on this journey together. We're locked on the same planet. We're locked in the same boat. We're in the same neighborhoods. We're working with the same people. There is no way to leave. You can't get off. You can't escape Mormonism. And once you accept that, you accept what it was and what it is and what it can be, you know? After the Buddha achieved enlightenment, He got up from the bow tree, and he went down to, there was a milk maiden, which is kind of convenient, that she had a bowl of milk, right? And he took the bowl of milk from her, and he drank it. And so he was violating all these laws. He wasn't allowed to touch or come near a maiden. He wasn't allowed to drink the milk because he was part of an ascetic movement. What he did is he basically discovered the middle way, that his pursuit of enlightenment with the ascetics had him like trying to eschew every mortal pleasure to arrive at the state of non-attachment so that he was not affected by the world. That was the goal of the movement. But it was only when he actually achieved enlightenment did he recognize that there was no particular rule, there was no particular course that could be outlined that would show that. And that's why, like, Chinese Buddhas are always shown as kind of chubby. They're the ones I like the best. So that's because it's saying you can't go too far down one path or too far down the middle or too far down the other. You have to find that middle balance. And it's the same thing with us and our own heritage. You cannot rip it out of your soul of what you were, and you don't want to. A lot of it was positive. There was some negative, true. But oftentimes we can learn more in life from our mistakes. We can learn more from what we chose to believe that was incorrect. We can learn more from our mistakes. And to get to the point where you can say, I was a Mormon. I was a believing Mormon. I believed this. I believed that. This helped shape my worldview. I probably need to interrogate my own views on race a little bit more because I grew up in a church that was racist that didn't believe it was so. I probably brought some of that with me. I grew up in a church that had a structure that systematically marginalized women. I need to be very careful about how I treat women. I lived in a church where I was bred to submit to authority and to just take on what they're saying. I need to be aware of that. But if I turn instead just to becoming anti-authoritarian, which is the knee-jerk reaction, I am not going to find it that way either. The truth is seldom found in just reversing a falsehood. The truth has to be found on its own path. And that path includes everything that we've discovered, everything that we run into. Let's talk about the remedy to this problem. No one gets left behind. We have to acknowledge that we're all the same. And having that perspective of 15 years, that's where I say, you know, this you can recognize in the fresh ex-Mormons just how Mormon they are. And just how much they have those ideas. That fades with time. The good news is, if you are angry, if you are sad, you can get on a path where you will no longer be angry and sad. And actually, it will come to you if you do nothing. If you don't keep feeding the anger and the sadness, you'll get over it. But there's better ways to get over it than other. We need to recognize the diversity of our Mormon identity. There's a couple of events that I took 4 years off from all this. I stepped away completely. I left Facebook. I retreated completely. There's sometimes so much pain on all sides that it just gets too overwhelming, right? But what I've recognized, and partly from the work that Lindsay has been doing, literally going down to Short Creek, for me, that is so scary. You know, like that was a place that you did not go, because I had grown up in a church that had vilified us. We're no different. We're all part of this same heritage. I grew up in a church that had vilified the reorganized church. But I've never met a group of people who are so welcoming and compassionate and understanding as everyone I've met from that church. And when I stopped trying to separate myself and say, I am no longer a Mormon, I rebelled. I can't rebel. It's me. I can't run away from myself. And it's me for the good and for the bad. And I know that part of what I am came from all this stuff. And I love reminiscing. I love the church that I grew up in. It had its problems, no doubt. But it was this culturally rich. You know, we had plays and bazaars and sports fields and leagues. And we had this identity. We knew people. I had this opportunity my children don't have. We had this gentleman who lived right across the street from me. He was a bomber in World War II. And he would get up and tell us about these bombing runs. What a gift, because most of the people in World War II didn't even talk about that. My children, I have stretched. They do not interact with anybody basically older than me. Because as ex-Mormons, we have failed. We have failed the teenagers. We have failed the children. We have failed to build anything for them. Now, that doesn't mean it's an individual failure. There's plenty of people who found communities, who founded communities, who've done that. I don't mean to cast shade on every person who's ever left the church. But we say the church is wrong and the church is bad, but we fail to give a viable alternative. And oftentimes, ex-Mormonism is a movement of privilege. I sent out onto Facebook a couple days ago and said, okay, you got all these extra hours, and you got all this extra money. What are you doing with it? And I didn't hear bad answers. I heard things like yoga. I heard things like travel. That's fine if you got money. Listen, I'm not going to find any spiritual fulfillment out of yoga. I can tell you that. So that's I love intersectionality or whatever. That's small-bodied privilege or whatever. But you hear what I'm saying? I can't remember. I tried to find who said this, and I haven't been able to find it on Google. So maybe I'll claim it. It wasn't me. Atheism is a privilege of the rich. Because if you are a poor dirt farmer, or you're locked in the brothels of Calcutta, where you were born and where you're going to die, the idea that this is it, this is all I get, and I ain't getting out of this, that's not a very compelling idea. Christianity grew amongst the slaves in Rome because it gave them hope. It gave them something else besides the dirty existence that they had. That had very little hope and very little to offer them. And we've done the same thing with secularism, with atheism, with all these new movements, of which I am a part. If you're really smart and you can read a lot of books and buy books, it's a fun time. If you can afford alcohol and you can go to parties, but you know, it's been too many years, I've seen the destruction. I've seen the people who disappear because they stop going to parties because they have a problem with alcohol and they lose their community support. I have a very good friend of mine who is as atheist as they come. He has advanced stage MS now. He's had it for years. He was rebaptized 2 years ago because the church can take care of him. We can't. We won't. We don't. But the church did. They took him back like that. He still doesn't believe any of it, but it's his people. It's where he returned home. And at first that makes me sad. It made me really sad to think about that we failed him. But then I realized saying, no, we didn't, because we are them. And they are us. And those of us who have left are on a little side branch. But we can't really kill our identity, and we shouldn't kill our identity. There's a certain paradox in resigning, actually, if you think about it. There's a common debate among ex-Mormons if you should resign or if you shouldn't. And in full disclosure, I did resign in 2012, but I turned it into a media spectacle, so I get a pass, right? I did resign. I made that choice to do so, but it's playing to the same narrative again. To resign is to acknowledge that it all makes sense. Actually, the Supreme Court case that defined whether or not you can leave a religion came out of this state and out of Mormonism. And the Supreme Court determined that to leave an organization, all you have to do is say, I'm done, I'm no longer a member. And you are no longer a member, the Supreme Court said. But yet we still play these games. But whose games are they? They're the corporation's games. Because when we look at the history of Joseph Smith, he did practice excommunication, but he showed an open heart to people who were willing to come back. And he took them back almost immediately. And so we have to stop buying into these narratives that are pushed on us because the corporation doesn't own the church. I'm going to talk about two movies now. The first one is a classic one that you've all seen called Meatballs from the early 80s. And do you know, because it was rated PG so you could all see it. Meatballs was the classic camp movie, right? It had all the poor, misfit kids on one side of the lake and all the rich, preppy kids on the other side of the lake. And in the movie, they're having a camp battle, you know, where you've seen it's played out in 100 different movies. You know, they're going to do the race and they're going to do the thing. And there's the night before the big kerfuffle, the big thing going on. And one guy says, "Hey, come on, why are we doing this? We're all just going to lose. It's over. We lose every year." Like And then Tripper, who's played by Bill Murray, he gives him a speech. He said, "That's the attitude that we don't need. Sure, the Mohawks, that's the other camp. They've beaten us 12 years in a row. Sure, they're great athletes. They got the best equipment. They have personal masseuses. They have all this kind of stuff. They have electrocardio. They do 40 hours, la, 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 la. They're the best group since East and West Germany got together," all this big speech. But then he says, "But it doesn't matter." And he starts leading the kids in a chant. "It just doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. There's this battle between these two camps, and it's their whole purpose." And he's telling the kids, "This thing doesn't matter. It's all a game. The outcome doesn't matter at all. It's all an illusion. You think you're losing to these guys, but there's nothing here. It just doesn't matter." Right? The second movie was, of course, the great War Games. In War Games, if you remember, there is a scientist who helps design like the first AI computer called Whopper, who he named Joshua. His name is Stephen Falcon. And the kids know that this thing is getting ready to launch World War III. The computers locked them out and is going to launch the missiles because they played these scenarios. And I really love this scene because they hunt him down. He's had his death faked and all this kind of stuff. And the scientist basically says, why are you trying to do this? And then he points, he's got these dinosaurs around. He's like, "These guys were once the greatest species. You know, they ruled the earth and they're gone now." And then he's talking about tic-tac-toe to the kids. He's trying to get them to understand. And what I like about the movie is he's never proven wrong. Like the hero overcomes this philosopher who's saying, your game is futile. But he's still there. You can go watch the movie again. And he says, "Do you play tic-tac-toe anymore?" He asks the two kids. And they say, "Yeah, of course." And he says, "But you don't play it anymore, right?" And she says, "No, we don't play it anymore. Why don't you play?" And she says, "It's a boring game. It always ends up in a tie." And then he says, "Exactly. There's no way to win. The game itself is pointless. But back in the war room, they believe you can win a nuclear war, that there can be acceptable losses." And then at the end, they get this computer to run through the scenarios over and over and over and over again, while this computer is getting close to cracking the missile codes. It's ready to launch. And it's locked everybody out. It's ready to start World War III. And finally, the computer, boils out. And then it reboots. And we're all sitting there in anticipation because, you know, reboots are really exciting times. And Joshua, the computer, comes on and says, "Greetings, Professor Falcon." Or isn't that how computers talk? "Greetings, Professor Falcon." And he says, "Hello, Joshua." And Joshua, the computer, says, "A strange game. The only winning move is not to play. How about a nice game of chess? We are locked in a strange game. What we are fighting about doesn't matter. There is more that unites us all than divides us. At the end of the day, we are people. We're people who suffer from addiction. We're people who have divorces. We're people who die. We're people who have children who need help. And we are pointing at this game of metaphysical belief that exists only in this moment of time. If you fast forward civilization 1,000 years, likely they will believe in a new volume of nonsense, like they have throughout all history. But we think our nonsense in this moment matters one single bit. The only way we can win this game is not to play. We have to stop throwing punches at one another. And like we have to start building something new.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Anson Park, Executive Director of the Sunstone Education Foundation. I want to invite you to our weekly Sunstone Firesides. Do you remember those? Firesides that they used to have dating all the way back to the 1930s, when the LDS Church would hold monthly meetings to discuss really important gospel topics. Those meetings became known endearingly as Firesides. In January of 2019, Sunstone launched a new podcast that incorporates a nod to these Firesides. Featuring a weekly evening podcast, it will display a range of hosts, all women, as they chat with diverse guests from across the Mormon spectrum. The hosts are all female-identifying that represent a broad perspective in Mormonism. These podcasts will be released every Thursday evening, so you can have that fireside feel brought right into your living room. So grab a cup of cocoa or coffee, since at Sunstone there is more than one way to Mormon. Snuggle up under a blanket and listen to incredible interviews by and from incredible people. You can support women and their work in Mormon studies, which is desperately needed, by donating at sunstone.org or becoming a monthly subscriber. Go to sunstone.org and click on the podcast tab for more info. We hope you enjoy it as much as we do.
In the last session, you were talking about how you looked forward to the time when we could kind of get together. We didn't fight anymore. But it's right here. It's right now, in this room. There are people who believe, there are people who don't believe, there are people who believe different things, and we have done it. It's here. We need to own the fact that we have done it. Now, it may not be the scale we want to do, but we have done it. I think that Sunstone has been positioned into the right point. The right point is that everybody hates Sunstone equally. That means it's the only organization, in my esteem, that is anywhere near the middle. There is a long shot that we can repair the cultural Mormonism. It's a big ask, and one that's been done a few times in history, but not very often. If you look too big, if you focus too big, if you focus small, we did it today, and we can do it tomorrow. And the organization that's best and most likely to have that happen right now is this organization. And I have been to the Sunstone offices. You do not recognize how little money this organization has. How the people who work for this organization do so on sacrifice that you would not believe. If Sunstone had the operational budget of one ward in the United States, it would probably triple its income. The people who work there work for, well, let's put it this way, if they went into like management at Arctic Circle, they would probably make more money. And that is an indictment of all of us. I have never been as generous with my money as I was with the church. And we have a strange culture. The biggest weird psychological coup the church ever did is get all of us to send so much money and yet convince us that organizations should not have money, that would be priestcraft. And unfortunately, the ex-Mormons bring that with them. And we, the organizations that are there trying to help people in the aftermath are all starving for even the basics, to pay the electric bill, to do those things. that people, I guarantee you, every ex-Mormon or fringe Mormon celebrity you know is sweeping the floors and putting their own money in the pot because there's so little. But we can take what we've done here of bridging the gap, of coming together, even though we fundamentally disagree on many, many things. But what unites us is bigger than what divides us. And we can take this little bit and we can make it a little bit bigger. And we can make it a little bit bigger. The last 2 years has been very depressing for me. I've suffered a lot of anxiety and a lot of rage, frankly, at the state of the country that I love and the culture that I love. But what I realized is that I am focusing on the wrong thing. I do not influence national politics at all. But I can make my neighbor's life better. I can make connection at places like this. And if we all stop worrying so much about the big picture and worrying about this micro world, how do we build bridges with the folks that we have problems with? How do we let things go for our own benefit? Anger at what's happened to us and what's happening to our movement and the things that have happened to you, I guarantee, you earned and you deserve rage. You earned anger. But anger is toxic. Anger can be justified and anger can make us do the right thing and make us fight, but carrying anger around will destroy you. I have seen it. I've felt it. And just because you're right, it's joked about in the ex-Mormon world. Boyd K. Packer said, not all truth is useful. He's right. Because your mom might say something to you that is hurtful and wrong, but scorching her back from it might be the truth, but it gets you nothing. And that's where we each have to individually reach across. And compromise means giving up some of your cherished things. Compromise means that we are able to just put some things aside and give up our righteous indignation. You have all been wronged. I validate that. And you are all correct to extract a cost for the price that you have paid. But what good would it do? There's only two things that really we do in this world. We consume. I like to consume. I'm a hedonist as far as it won't get me into too much trouble. So I like to consume. And then there's the things that we create. Everything that you consume is going to go away a lot sooner than you want it to. We are here for a short time. We popped into existence. And we popped into existence at this time. Most of us won't die of rickets or of scurvy. Like, we're well fed. Most of us don't suffer real cold. Most of us have hospitals nearby. We sprang into existence, whatever miracle that was. And we're only here for a short time. And then our light goes out. And that's you too. And you sprang into existence. And you exist right now. And we are here together. What an incredible miracle. There's no even way to say the probability of it. We can't even explain it. The fact that we have consciousness. And we know that we evolved. And we know that we evolved to feel pain and anxiety and to suffer. We know that. And we know exactly where it came from. And we can either embrace that, or we can say, I've just got so much, such short time. And everything that I accumulate, everything that I put in the bank, it's all going to go away. None of that matters, even in the short run. But what I can do is pay it forward. We are all here because of the blood, tears, and sacrifice of our ancestors and our Mormon ancestors. And that goes for people who, you know, I'm here because of the blood, sweat, and tears of the people at Plymouth Rock, who I'm not related to. I'm here because of wars and revolutions and fights and deaths that I don't even know about. But there were people who were willing to pay it forward. I am resting. Everything I have comes from people who are dead and gone, who gave it back. And that's really the only thing that matters. And I don't want to institute some kind of like cultural, Chinese cultural revolution that you don't matter. You do. You matter infinitely. That's the miracle of it. But we can affect the lives of people around us if we can give up our pettiness, if we can start listening to one another. And listening means listening to people who are wrong. They're so wrong. I want to tell them that they're wrong all the time. They're obviously wrong. Can't they see it? It doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. It's what Joshua told us. It's a strange game. The only way we can win this battle, the battle between the ex-Mormons and the Mormons, the battle between the FLDS and the battle between the evangelicals, is not to play the game. Don't accept the rules. You can do whatever you want. I have had, over my career, probably 20 different people come to me and say on the sly, I really miss prayer. I don't believe in the church anymore, but I really miss prayer. And I always give them the same answer. Prayer works as well now as it always did before. Nothing's changed. It's a false paradigm that tells you if you don't believe in God, you can't pray. Where does that rule come from? We have these things that we have to let go on. I don't know if we can make a difference. I don't know if I can make a difference. I don't know if anybody will listen to me. But I'm going to try. Because this is my people. And I've experienced it from both sides. And I'm hoping to find that middle way of saying, together we can reach out. Together we can build something. And it's going to be small. But that's wonderful. I would be no more happy about us connecting if there were 7,000 people in this room than I am with the small group that's here now. We can only handle even a few people. So we should focus on those people and figure out how to bridge that divide. And just stop worrying. Who cares what Elder Nielsen says? Who cares? I look back at church history and all the pronouncements and all the magazines and all the things. It's all just gone. It's dust in the wind. 98% of what the church has said, no one even remembers, right? And so we should stop taking it so seriously now. It just doesn't matter. What matters is people. What matters is our connection. What matters is what we can build. Well, I think I've hammered that point home. I need to call you all out again and say, if you can, make it to Sunstone. I went to Sunstone 2002, and it has grown and diversified. Everybody you've heard of is there. It's the big tent. We need your voice. We need your presentation. Others need to hear from you. It's worth it. It's worth it to find a place where we can reconnect. It's worth it for us as ex-Mormons to stand in the clearing and say, you can't get rid of us. We're here. Let's talk. It's worth it for the Mormons, who I've had wonderful ones in my life. I'll tell you a very brief story. We had a child going to the hospital about a year ago. I have a lot of great friends. I didn't tell them. So I don't want to indict the people I know. The next day, there was a dinner there from the ward. How they even figured it out, I don't even know. But they were there. For me. Many of them see me as an enemy. And they gave me a meal. I didn't ask. They were there. And I have not been there for them. And they are my people. And I think that we can take that and we can build something. But we means each of you. That's all we can do. We each have to pay a price. We can't get this for free. I always ran out of ways to end talks. I think we are broadcasting this one, so it will be up there. I guess I should plug that I'm back recording the Sunstone podcast. We've had some great episodes. We want you on there, and we want you to participate. So thank you for making the Arizona conference. Arizona has always felt like a second home to me. I've always had friends down here. Every time I've come, I have felt just welcome. And there's these wonderful communities. Thank you so much for being welcoming to Sunstone and for helping us build this thing and for helping us. What's that? We're going to cut the stone out of the hill and let it roll down, and somehow it gets bigger. I don't know. Yeah, we're going to do that. Let's do that. All right. Thanks, everybody.